From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Look, there are a lot of columnists out there in the World Wide Web, if that's what we call them. A lot of the time we call them bloggers. And yes, you can find a lot of good work. But John Avalon was interested in the writing of another medium, of newspapers, a form not yet gone, but certainly fading. Avalon and some colleagues are out with the second book in a series of the greatest newspaper columns. He calls it an art form that deserves to be saved and savored. Today in the program, Avalon is joining us to take us through some of these pieces, what he calls short stories that really happened. There's Mike Royko and Jimmy Breslin and Nellie Bly and Steinbeck, Hemingway. Avalon says this kind of writing, trying to make sense of something and turn it around on a deadline, is a reminder of the power of a column to offer a little light along with the heat. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When's the last time you read a newspaper column? And how about this? When's the last time you read a newspaper column with the actual newspaper stretched out in front of you? Well, for some of us, the answer is all the time. But let's be honest, the form and the medium itself is in a period of transformation. There's still good writing out there, of course, because when something happens that is tragic or scandalous or outrageous, we need someone to help us put things in perspective. And for decades and decades, that time that stretched from the late 19th century through the early 21st century, readers found that perspective in a newspaper column. The writer and columnist himself, John Avalon, and some of his colleagues have been collecting the work of some of these classic newspaper columnists. And they're out with their second volume, which is giving us an opportunity to talk about the form and the stories themselves. The book is called Deadline Artists, Scandals, Tragedies, and Triumphs, More of America's Greatest Newspaper Columns. And John Avalon is joining us today to talk about it. John is a senior columnist for Newsweek and The Daily Beast and a contributor to CNN. He's the author of several books, including Wingnuts, How the Lunatic Fringe is Hijacking America. Along with Jesse Angelo and Errol Lewis, he edited this collection. And John is joining us today from a studio in New York City. And John Avalon, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be with you as always, Doug. Thank you.
I guess I wanted to start with your own connection to this story or these pieces. What was it that got you started on all of this? Was it your own affection for particular columnists?
You know, it began when I started writing a column 10 years ago, and I'd previously been a speechwriter, and speechwriters invariably, it's an esoteric profession, but they invariably get a book by William Safire, himself a columnist after being a speechwriter in the White House, called Lend Me Your Ears. It's an anthology of the greatest speeches of all time. And, you know, you learn how to write a speech by listening to speeches, but by reading great speeches. And then when I started out as a newspaper columnist shortly after 9/11, I wanted to know where that book was. Where was the book that brought together all this great deadline literature, this literary journalism, so that I could read the best of the past and learn from it? And it was, to my amazement, no book like that really existed. And I spoke to Jack Newfield, who was a colleague of mine at the time of the New York Sun. Mm. Errol Lewis and I were working together. And Jack was the wise man in the newsroom. He was a legendary New York newspaper columnist, had worked at the New York Post, the Daily News, was friends with Bobby Kennedy and Muhammad Ali. And we asked him what his favorite newspaper column was. And he sort of stroked his chin and said he'd get back to us. And he came back and he said, The Death of Frankie Jerome by Westbrook Pegler. Never heard of Westbrook Pegler. I'd never heard of that column. So we went hunting for it. It hadn't been anthologized since 1924. And it opened up a new world because when I read this column, it read like a short story. This was literature. Yeah. I met Jimmy Breslin, Jack's good friend, a little while later, through Jack, and he had this similar reminiscence, remembering all these long-gone columns that hadn't ever been anthologized. And you saw it was part of almost an oral tradition of newspaper columnists in big cities, but many of these folks had been basically forgotten. And that's when the process began. Jack died in 2004, but we talked about it a lot before he passed away. And it became this labor of love that was part education, part entertainment. And it made us realize, as young journalists, as young columnists, just how high the bar was, that especially in the heyday of what can now, I think, be called the newspaper era,
right.
That these folks were deadline artists. They were stylists. They wrote, importantly, reported columns, which is a tradition I try to keep alive in my column, but is increasingly falling by the wayside. So this is simultaneously, these books are love letters to the great journalism of the past and a reminder to us in the new generation of how high the bar is and how much more can be done with the form than simply writing opinions.
Did it surprise you how hard it was to find some of these pieces? Because you've talked about the fact that you can't just go online and find this stuff, not all of it anyway.
No, the vast majority of it you can't. And that's why there was a sense of urgency. An enormous amount of time we spent in the library stacks. One of the columns in this new book, Scandals, Tragedies, and Triumphs, has a famous name. It's Damon Runyon on The Cinderella Man.
Yeah.
Folks at home might recognize that because it was the title of a very popular movie with Russell Crowe just a few years ago about the life of James J. Braddock, a boxer during the Depression. Everyone acknowledges in the movie press, in the stories online about James J. Braddock, that he got his nickname from Damon Runyon, who is perhaps most famous today as the playwright behind Guys and Dolls, but was best known in his own time, not just as a short story writer and playwright, but as a newspaper columnist.
Right.
One of the greats of all time. And no one, however, could find the column where Damon Runyon called James J. Braddock the Cinderella Man, called the Boxing Hall of Fame in upstate New York. They didn't have a copy. I called the biographers of James J. Braddock. They didn't have a copy. We ultimately found it in the stacks of the New York Public Library, in the pages of the New York Journal American. And it's one of the great columns in our Triumph section of the book. It had never been anthologized before. So these columns have been found. They have been ferreted out. Some of them existed almost more in legend than in being reprinted. But when you read the best of the past, these columns are all still so alive because of the vibrant writing, because they really do read like short stories. And some of them are funny and some of them are sad. In all cases, you're reading history written in the present tense when Marguerite Higgins is the first person to first journalist to enter the concentration camp of Dachau.
Yeah.
You know, you're there with her watching history unfold. And we just see it over and over again, the quality of the writing, the storytelling, that above all. And it took a lot of hunting, but it was such a pleasure to uncover some of this stuff. And we just hope that it will make more people appreciative of this American art form. And preserve and revive some of these reputations of people who have been sadly forgotten and deserve to be celebrated as great American journalists.
There's this epigraph you have for this volume of the book where you include this quote from the Chicago poet and columnist S.E. Is it Kaiser? Is that how we pronounce
Kaiser,
it?
I believe.
Kaiser, yeah. And he writes this. He writes that a columnist must be a poet, a wit, a philosopher, and a critic, among other things. And it got me wondering, what is the gift, really, John Avalon? Because you say in the book there's this urgency of news, but you also have to have that precision of poetry and literature, I guess.
I do think that great columnists can necessarily bring their own mix of perspective to column writing. I think it helps to be a good storyteller. It's essential to have compassion and interest in people, to have an iconoclastic view of the world, to be unflinching about expressing it. But there's so many different paths. Some people come to columnizing after working in government. Some people more regularly come to it after working beat journalism in the past, particularly the crime beat or the sports beat. And I think the best columnists don't get stuck in one genre. They can paint on a broader canvas. I think one of the things that's degraded the columnizing tradition in recent years, frankly, is the rise of partisan media, which we've discussed before on your show, because it's pigeonholed people. It's made them predictable. And frequently, in an unstable and constantly changing media environment, they start writing for editors and publishers, maybe even more than they did in the past. They play for the cheap seats. And when something's predictable, why bother paying attention? And people can make a lot of money doing that. But any independence, any integrity goes out the window. So I do think the storytelling's tradition is important, but everyone brings their own unique voice and set of experiences to it. And as S.E. Kaiser says in the bottom of that epigraph, it's about being trying to be wise and having perspective, but you lose the thread once you make a habit of taking yourself too seriously.
Right, right. Well, that's one of the things that you write about in the book itself, that these particular people who were writing, they tend to be romanticized as, you know, curmudgeonly and hard-bitten and hard-drinking, those kinds of things. But they tend to be more circumspect about their own jobs. They don't see themselves as romantic or even perfect or their work particularly enlightened all the time or tidy all the time. They were just sort of doing their job on a deadline, I guess.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, you know, this is the great gap between Hollywood's reimagining of American life and the reality.
Yeah.
You know, I think it is worth appreciating how much columnists have been a character in so many American films. They're sort of they're literary private eyes, you know, and they're accountable to nobody but the public good. And they frequently are portrayed, as you said, as cynical and hard drinking and disheveled. At the end of the day, like any profession, no matter how romanticized from the outside, it is people going to work and trying to do their best every day. And there are debates, and the people in the profession have no illusions of perfection. And one of the pleasures, the small pleasures of putting together these books have been to put people who are great talents from the same era side by side. And some of them were great friends and some of them hated each other's guts.
Mm-hmm.
And all that sort of sniping that can preoccupy so much time and emotion fades away against the virtue of the work, the quality of the work. Westbrook Pegler, who I mentioned earlier, who was an incredibly talented columnist who ended his life bitter and crazy on the far right, and Hayward Bruhn, another one who is unjustly forgotten, who's in these books, they feuded publicly and viciously. But when you read their voices side by side, you do get a sense of these are different personalities, different values, but both great, great talents.
Yeah. I want to get to John, as many of these pieces as we can, talk about them. And
sure.
We've enlisted a local actor, Paul Kiernan, whom we gave the impossible task of coming in here this morning and trying to read as many of these as we could.
Great idea.
I want to start, though, with Murray Kempton. He wrote a piece this was November of 1955 in the New York Post. It's a piece called The Southern Gentleman. Talk about Murray Kempton, first of all, because you talk about how David Remnick of The New Yorker called him this. He said he was a moralist who does not preach, an artist who reports.
That's right. And Remnick nails the essence and the heart of a great columnist. Remnick has an entire profile on Murray Kempton in his book, The Devil Problem, which is brilliant and beautifully written. Kempton, in my mind, is one of the greats. Having done two of these books now, to my mind, there are actually three figures who stand out above all the rest of contemporary years. There's a good 12 that are in anybody's Hall of Fame, and
yeah,
some are still writing today. But Murray Kempton, Jimmy Breslin, and Mike Royko. And they all wrote for tabloids, very importantly. You know, they didn't write for broadsheets. These weren't the highfalutin society, you know, columnists who always got dinner invitations to the White House. These are folks who stayed close to the streets, often defiantly so. But Murray Kempton distinguished himself because and all wrote decidedly reported columns. But Murray Kempton had a gentleness and a grace and a lack of judgment to his columns, even though he had a deep streak of moralism. And in this column, The Southern Gentleman, he does something that is so hard to do and so beautiful, something that when I was writing Wingnuts, I recognized the challenge of how you write about an extremist, often somebody consumed with conspiracy theories or hate, while trying to understand them, while trying to let them speak for themselves, to treat a degree of empathy, and often they hang themselves in the eye of the reader, but to let it do that in their own words, not to project and simply polemicize the person involved. And it's never been done better than in this column called The Southern Gentleman.
Well, set this up for us. This is he doesn't actually reflect on the story that he's telling. He doesn't make, as you say, any judgments. He doesn't really say much beyond just reporting what he's seeing, which is really enough, I guess.
It's what is essential, and which is why some of these columns could be, it's a Chekhov short story. It's, you know, when
right,
it's in this tight focus and everything is used. And this is Murray Kempton did amazing reporting in the 1950s on the burgeoning civil rights movement and moral crises in the South. And his columns collected in a book called America Comes of Middle Age, again, long out of print. This is from that. And he has a series of vignettes, stories, columns in this case for the New York Post, not a place you'd necessarily, it's a great tabloid, but you realize that it was publishing literature in a tabloid at the time. He interviews a gentleman in Louisiana who's running an organization called the Southern Gentleman. And this is a white supremacist, white separatist group. And it sees kinship in the government of South Africa at the time. And it is trading in the most polluted conspiracy theories. But Kempton frames it by saying at the beginning, he describes him and says he's almost totally impossible to dislike, and then proceeds to let the man hang himself with his own words.
The come-on flyers from the Southern Gentlemen's Organization of Louisiana are tricked out rather drearily with a stock drawing of an antebellum colonel, goateed and string-tied. Their living expression, as in most of the South, is thicker of blood and closer to the earth. J.B. Easterly, Southern Gentleman No. 1, is a spike-haired, square bifocaled, heavy-necked man of 61, alternating explosions of laughter and indignation. His grandchildren call him Pop-Pop, and he's totally impossible to dislike. The Southern Gentlemen are Louisiana's militant symbol of the counterattack against racial integration. As such, they maintained warm fraternal relations with a brotherhood of resistance ranging from Citizens Council of Mississippi to the Apartheid Bund in South Africa. Its Mississippi and Cape Town brothers are, of course, the government. In Baton Rouge, at least, J.B. Easterly commands a ragged outpost in the shed next to his bungalow, which serves both as home office of the Southern Gentleman and his own modest, prefabricated concrete step business. As tycoon and opinion maker, J.P. Easterly is his own secretary, turning from time to time to assault the typewriter with his thick fingers and render his accounts. As opinion maker, J.B. Easterly's expression is somewhat inhibited by his two youngest grandchildren, who toddle around the office step and have to be shooed out of hearing whenever he wants to advert to the prime subject of miscegenation. "I'm a very illiterate man," says J.B. Easterly. "My daddy went broke when I was in college. I was raised on a cotton and cane plantation. When I was a boy, I hardly knew what a white child was. We have no secrets here. All we want to do is maintain segregation by legal means. We're definitely opposed to rough stuff. We believe the Negro race should advance. Look, boy, it's an accident you're a white man. We think the Negro should be proud to be a Negro and be just as good as God gave him the brain power to be. If we got rough on them, we feel we'd be doing an injustice to 95% of the race."
Murray Kempton. And it goes on from there, of course, and it gives you just kind of a sense of the cadence. And it's like you said, you described it as these are short stories that actually happened. And the dialogue is the thing that's extraordinary in this particular piece, but you see it throughout these stories, which I think surprised me in some way.
Well, it surprised you probably because that is part of what could be described as a lost art in today's columnizing.
Yeah.
Part of the urgency behind putting these columns together, and it's a standard I fall short of in my job all the time, but at least now I'm aware of the precedent and the opportunity, is to tell stories, is to, you know, it's evident much of this came in the day where it was radio, frankly, not television or movies. Vivid descriptive writing had real value. There was an obligation to make a scene come alive in the mind of a reader. And that's what makes this so exciting to read, because this is history written in the present tense. And in this case, you are there at a time and from a voice who is articulating in his own mind reasonably a defense of segregation that we would consider horrific and barbaric, and yet you can hear the echoes of his argument in some people today, and that makes it so much valuable, so much more valuable, so relevant and urgent and fascinating, and not simply a museum piece.
But before we head to a break, I want to play one more piece. This one comes from Joseph Cookman, and he writes about the death of Huey Long here. This is a piece that he wrote for the New York Post. This was September of 1935. Of course, this is Louisiana's populist governor, Huey Long. He was assassinated in the state house that he himself had commissioned. And there's a brief excerpt here right at the top of this particular piece. which I was really taken to this piece, John Avalon, just the kind of description and the kind of well, it's the description of a dead man laying there.
Yeah, it. I mean, this is a piece that, if we're going for alternating playwrights, this almost had a Clifford Odets feel to it, especially the way it ends with a carpenter hammering away in the background. But the description is Huey Long lying in state in the state capitol building he commissioned and looking almost impossibly dull compared to the figure he cut in life.
The Louisiana peasant who became Louisiana's king is on view in his capital in his coffin today. The face, which in life never held the same expression for more than 2 seconds, is fixed in a studied smirk, an undertaker's idea of how Huey Long should have looked. Here, set forth in a dinner jacket, is the man who sold large substitute to hook-wormed sharecroppers. The shirt front is as smooth as a planed board, as white as a jailbird's face. The black tie flares with the nonchalant perfection of a drawing in a fashion magazine. You look down at it for the brief moment that the guards, uniformed and plain-clothed, permit. You can't believe that here is anything but a bad wax sculpture of a superhumanly alive man, and painted at that. It is so much like one of those figures you see in the store windows which remind you of somebody, but you can't be quite sure just whom. Huey wouldn't have liked it, and his words wouldn't have been fit to print.
That's Joseph Cookman's piece, a piece of it anyway, just an excerpt from The Louisiana's Kingfish Lies in State. This was a piece in 1935. And you get a sense, John Avalon, there's a little bit of contempt just under, not completely overt, but it's just under the writing there.
That's right. And it's important to appreciate these are columns.
Yeah.
This is not straight reporting. But because it's a reported column, you get so much more texture and depth. You know, the way that column ends, he follows a woman who's in line to see Huey Long,
right.
named Mrs. Fawn. And he follows her in line, and she says, you know, I don't know whether he was right all the time, but I guess he was for poor folks. I'm poor folks. He said every man's a king, and I guess he meant it. Then he goes, now Mrs. Fawn was abreast of the column. There was steam on the lenses of her horn-rimmed glasses, and she brushed at them angrily. Miss Fawn took a quick look at the coffin, and then doddered out into the rain. The crowd swallowed her. Inside, a carpenter whistled and pounded a nail. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, it really
and
is.
We realize that potential is just as open to us today. The metabolism of news is faster. There's an emphasis on blogging and getting it first and quick and clever. But nothing compares to that storytelling.
John Avalon is with us. He's a senior columnist for Newsweek and the Daily Beast. He co-edited Deadline Artists, Scandals, Tragedies, and Triumphs, more of America's greatest newspaper columns. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the art and the craft of a really good newspaper column. The writer John Avalon is passionate about this form. Of course, he's a columnist himself, so he appreciates the good ones and the impact they have on the way we respond to tragedy or scandal or triumph. John has co-edited a book called Deadline Artists. It's the second, actually, of this volume. Deadline Artists, Scandals, Tragedies, and Triumphs, more of America's greatest newspaper columns. And he's joining us to take us through some of them. So, John Avalon, let's talk about Mike Royko. He's a classic, if there ever was one. And the piece you have included, one of the pieces you have included from Mike Royko in this book, is I guess just it's kind of an iconic piece. The Sinatra letter is how I'm thinking about it.
Yeah,
this was from May of 1976. Appeared in the Chicago Daily News. I want to play an excerpt from this, or maybe even a couple. Set this up for us.
Sure. Royko really was one of the classics, and his range was extraordinary. In this book, we have four of his columns. This is the Sinatra letter, a column about a young man whose face had been blown off in Vietnam, a column where he writes about his wife's death, and a column where he remembers Jackie Robinson's debut in Chicago. But this column is famous because it's funny and it's confrontational. He had published a column about Frank Sinatra coming to Chicago, and it had been unflattering about the police details and the alleged mob connections. And so he got a letter from a Sinatra lackey delivered to the newsroom where Sinatra threatened him. And he published the letter in his column and then responded to it.
Right. Here's the setup to it. Yeah, let's play this first part because it's I have to say it's great that he just included the Sinatra letter itself, which seems completely audacious.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's bold.
A short man with a thick neck just walked in and handed me an envelope and said, "This is from Mr. Sinatra." Sure enough, it was. A letter from old Blue Eyes himself telling me off good for my column about how he has a 24-hour police guard outside his hotel suite while he's in Chicago. Here's what he says. "Let me start this note by saying, I don't know you, and you don't know me. I believe if you knew me, first, you would find immediately that I do not have an army of flunkies. Secondly, neither myself, nor my secretary, nor my security man put in the request for police protection. It's something that's far from necessary. It's quite obvious that your source of information stinks, but that never surprises me about people who write in newspapers for a living. They rarely get their facts straight. If the police decide they wanted to be generous with me, I appreciate it. If you have any beefs with the Chicago police force, why not take it out on them instead of me, or is that too big a job for you? And thirdly, who in the hell gives you the right to decide how disliked I am if you know nothing about me? The only honest thing I read in your piece is the fact that you admit you..."
And Mike Royko goes on, and we get the piece, with the whole piece from Frank Sinatra. And then he goes back, and I guess, John Evelyn, as you said, he goes back and responds to each of Frank Sinatra's contentions or bits, I guess, right?
Very, very methodically and with a very Chicago spirit.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
It's just a great takedown. And in some ways, this anticipates comments and the kind of dialogue we have today. But especially at that time, this was really audacious.
Yeah. He calls him a pimp. Sinatra does, Royko. And then he says this. He says, "I will allow you to pull my hairpiece," in quotations. "If it moves, I will give you another $100,000. If it does not, I will punch you in the mouth." It's so great. Now, here's Royko's response, the final part of his column from the Chicago Daily News. This was in 1976.
"If you can prove, without a doubt, that I have ever been a pimp, I will give you $11.69 in cash. You're not the only high roller in town. I don't want to pull your hair. People would think we're a couple of weirdos. However, for the sake of a sporting proposition, I'll do it. But only if I can make new terms for the bet. If your hair doesn't move, you can give me a punch in the mouth. I figure that fans who can't get tickets for your show will pay 50 cents to touch my swollen lip. But if it does move, never mind the 100 G's. You give me one of your old bow ties and an original recording of Birth of the Blues. I still say it was your best song."
Mike Royko, the great Mike Royko.
Just so good, right? Yeah, I mean, first of all, the pen is mightier than the sword. And second of all, the way he turns it into, "I've always liked you." He talks about the time he was in Korea, how somewhere there's this Frank Sinatra fan club in Korea, and it's because of him. It's a great piece. And again, the personality shines through. And that's something that should be present in great columnizing, not just opinion, certainly not just facts and stats, but a person standing on his own, fighting against the prevailing winds.
Yeah. Let's talk about Jimmy Breslin. He's another favorite of mine and a really a classic, iconic writer. There's a piece, a really lovely piece that you include, one in particular of Jimmy Breslin's. This was from 1981. It's a piece called Beyond Politics. And it's the story of Pamela Mayo, who loses her husband, this Air Force sergeant named Joel Mayo, when the helicopters that were dispatched to rescue the American hostages in Iran went down in the desert. And it's just a beautiful, lovely. It's just a lovely piece of writing.
It's an elegy, and it is eternal, and it reads for any family that's ever lost a loved one in the service. And again, you read it, and you think about the near miracle of this appearing in your daily newspaper,
right?
Something this enduring. And then the great injustice if it were to be just lost. And it is worth saying before we go into it that Jimmy Breslin is still with us.
Yeah.
He is alive. And many of the folks in this book are not. Now, you should say there are great Deadline artists still writing today. Steve Lopez, the LA Times, comes to mind. Carl Hyas in the Miami Herald. Mm-hmm. Mitch Albom, the Detroit mm-hmm. Free Press. But Breslin is one of the all-time greats, and this piece is beautiful.
Know that the day belongs to Pamela Mayo, whose husband, an Air Force sergeant, died in the desert in Iran last April. In the recording of the 444 days of hostages in Iran, in tales of spies and clerks, of political fakery and national will, of honor and dishonor, the purity of her husband's act places him above all. He died trying to rescue other human beings. On morning television yesterday, each mention of the hostages would cause one of Pam Mayo's kids to call out and the others in the family of four boys and a mother to run through the house to the set. The reason that it's so important to us is that maybe it won't be over for us until it's over for them, Pam Mayo, who was 31, was saying. Her husband, Joel Mayo, who was known as Buck, was an in-flight engineer on C-130 transports. In Iran, age 34, he died in the darkness when a helicopter crashed into a C-130. She lives as a stranger in a town where she was born, Harrisville, Michigan. In the morning, as she heard discussions on television about the difficulties the hostages could have in becoming used to having families around them again, she thought of the day in 1966 when she met her husband. She was 18 and in high school, and a girlfriend brought him into her mother's kitchen in Harrisville. He was an airman, assigned to the base fire department in Worth Smith Air Force Base in Oscoda, Michigan. He was Irish and Indian from Florida, and she was Yugoslavian from the forest land of Upper Michigan. They were married and began 13 and a half years of living on air bases. And she remembered the last time she saw him. It was a spring night at Fort Walton Beach, Florida, and he was leaving for temporary duty that he would not talk about. Many weeks before that, FBI agents suddenly started interviewing his family and friends because they said Buck was being given a top-secret security clearance. Once that happened, his wife never asked him about his military work.
I want to skip forward to the last part of this essay, I guess it is. But I'm trying to imagine reading it in the days after this tragedy. And this is something you write about in the book itself, that what we're looking for is some perspective. And I guess this would help us sort of put things in perspective, help us kind of orient ourselves to it all.
And I think that is the purpose of a columnist to a large extent. And even more so today, we are inundated with information. That's not sufficient to make sense of things, especially on the all-important human dimension. And columnists gain trust with us. Over time, we learn the ones we trust. We learn the ones we like. We develop an intimate relationship with them that goes beyond politics, to borrow the title of this column. And it is about creating perspective, about urging compassion, and sometimes with humor and sometimes not. This column is also beyond humor, which Breslin could frequently do better than anybody. But again, his range was such that this becomes a meditation. And when you think about opening a paper up and seeing something of this quality, it does make you realize that we don't see this enough anymore. We see a lot of polemics. We don't see a lot of human storytelling about individuals other than the columnists themselves, and that is something we could use more of.
And today, the nation celebrates its hostages. It examines them and pampers them and exalts. And President Carter leaves office with his engineer's determination intact. He had taken this problem and finally solved it. And Pam Mayo and her children, who gave the most, sit in front of a television set in Michigan and cheer. "When I came back here, people didn't know how to take me," she was saying. "I was alone. I wasn't divorced or embittered by my husband, and they had seen me on television." This is a small town up here. It's like a southern town without an accent. I've been away for over 13 years. Everything is taking a lot of time. Now it might be a little different. It's over for the hostages, and now it's over for me. I can begin the rest of my life. She never understood the politics of Iran. Last fall in Michigan, she forgot to register and did not vote in the November election. She doesn't want anybody tormenting her with the idea that her husband might have died because of a political campaign. All she knows is that he died as a hero of his country, and today, the day that belongs to her, we celebrate his heroism.
You know, listening to that, two things strike me. One is that I hope that by collecting this column, we don't just celebrate Jimmy Breslin and his artistry as he should be celebrated, but Pam Mayo and Buck Mayo, and reintroduce a new generation to that moment in history. I was 7 years old when that was written. I don't know that my generation appreciates that special operations mission that went horribly wrong, even though, frankly, it cast a shadow over the special ops mission to kill bin Laden. There was that precedent of a disaster. But to pay tribute to those families as well as the columnist, and Breslin does something here that he does in many of his greatest columns that can't be underestimated. In the first Deadline Artist Anthology, we have two columns of him that he wrote in the wake of JFK's assassination, where he interviews the gravedigger in a column, a famous column called It's an Honor, and the attending emergency room physician in Dallas. And those two columns, along with this, show that technique of not following the crowds, of talking to the individuals who are slightly off center stage, and the enormous capacity for compassion and storytelling and truth that comes with that added effort, where most journalists and columnists would cover the parade, would cover the hostages coming off the tarmac. Breslin went up to Michigan. Breslin interviewed the family and the enormous value added of that extra effort.
John Avlon is with us. He's a senior columnist for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. He co-edited this book. It's called Deadline Artist: Scandals, Tragedies, and Triumphs, More of America's Greatest Newspaper Columns. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer and columnist John Avlon. We're talking about his book, Deadline Artists, Scandals, Tragedies, and Triumphs, More of America's Greatest Newspaper Columns. John is joining us from a studio in New York City. John Avlon, we've got scandals, we've got tragedies and triumphs. Of course, disasters are part of some of the work in this particular one. And I wanted to talk about writers like, well, I want to play an excerpt from Jack London's piece, which is an extraordinary piece. This was from the San Francisco earthquake, his reporting in his column that he wrote on the San Francisco earthquake back in 1906.
So Jack London, many of the great columnists and journalists in this book might be best known to readers today as novelists, whether it's Ernest Hemingway, who people might not fully appreciate, got his start and much of his style writing for the Toronto Star. There's a column in here about bullfighting. Jack London, famous as an inspiration to the Beat Generation, one of the early iconic American novelists. In this piece, he gets an assignment to go up to San Francisco in the immediate aftermath of the devastating 1906 earthquake. And he records what he sees. And disasters are quintessential scandals and tragedies. And it's harrowing, and it echoes. And to see that classic American voice reporting at a scene of devastation, it's amazing literature, and it's harrowing reporting.
The earthquake shook down in San Francisco hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of walls and chimneys. But the conflagration that followed burned up hundreds of millions of dollars worth of property. There is no estimating within hundreds of millions the actual damage wrought. Not in history has a modern imperial city been so completely destroyed. San Francisco is gone. Nothing remains of it but memories and a fringe of dwelling houses on its outskirts. Its industrial section is wiped out. The business section is wiped out. Its social and residential section is wiped out. The factories and warehouses, the great stores and newspaper buildings, the hotels and palaces of the nabobs are all gone. There remains only the fringe of dwelling houses on the outskirts of what was once San Francisco. Within an hour after the earthquake shock, the smoke of San Francisco's burning was a lurid tower visible 100 miles away. And for 3 days and nights, this lurid tower swayed in the sky, reddening the sun, darkening the day, and filling the land with smoke. On Wednesday morning at 5:15 came the earthquake. A minute later, the flames were leaping upward. In a dozen different quarters south of Market Street, in the working-class ghetto, and in the factories, fires started. There was no opposing the flames. There was no organization, no communication. All the cunning adjustments of a 20th-century city had been smashed by the earthquake. The streets were humped into ridges and depressions and piled with the debris of fallen walls. The steel rails were twisted into perpendicular and horizontal angles. The telephone and telegraph systems were disrupted, and the great water mains had burst. All the shrewd contrivances and safeguards of man had been thrown out of gear by 30 seconds of twitching of the Earth's crust.
It's an amazing piece of writing. And you put it in the context of Hurricane Sandy or Katrina or any of those things, and it brings it right up to date. It doesn't seem dated at all.
That's right, and I'm glad you mentioned that perspective, because that's one of the things I think that reading history in general, but these pieces in particular, provides. You know, when you read about the devastation, San Francisco is gone, and then you realize that human beings rebuild. That's what we do. When you compare this piece by Jack London to some of the great columns written in the wake of 9/11, Steve Lopez and Michael Daley in particular, Peggy Noonan, you get their echoes and exchanges. Compare Hurricane Sandy to a piece by a forgotten but very famous journalist at the time named Winifred Black, a woman who wrote for the San Francisco Examiner, who bribed her way into Galveston in the immediate aftermath of that devastating hurricane that destroyed the town of Galveston entirely. The most deadly hurricane in American history, still by far. It provides perspective on our own times, and that is always helpful. That helps give us courage and a sense of, the horizon at whatever difficulties we might face. And the interplay between the columns are fascinating too. When you read Noah Brooks writing about the murder of President Lincoln, and then Merriman Smith about the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and Jack Newfield about the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, or Murray Kempton about the assassination of Malcolm X. You get these echoes, these conversations across generations that provide their own perspective. And it's one of the pleasures of putting a book together like this, and I hope reading a book like this.
You call it a tribute from one generation to another. And you've talked about the volume as something that you and your editors wanted to read as young journalists. What do you figure going through this now? You're on the second volume. What has it taught you about, about writing, about journalism, do you think?
It's a great question, Doug, and the answer is so much. I believe that the best rule for writing a book, or really writing anything, is that you should write what you would like to read. As a columnist, I've learned the importance of that tradition of the classic reported column, which has fallen out of favor as we spend our time with shorter opinionated driven dispatches and stat driven analysis and spend a lot of time with partisan skirmishes that can suck up a lot of oxygen that ultimately have very little to do with people's lives. I've learned the importance of storytelling, of vivid descriptive writing that doesn't rely on references but recreates dialogue and tells people's stories in ways that have bring scenes alive in people's minds. It's as basic as showing, not telling, that basic rule you learn in journalism school or at your English class, but too often has been put aside. The importance of a clear voice, a strong point of view, a strong lead, certainly to capture an attention. The importance of compassion and kindness and zigging when other people are zagging, of not simply piling on, but telling a story from a different perspective. If you can do all that, a great column, it educates and it entertains, and and it is telling a great story that adds real value, simply more than on the day's news, more than simply an additional layer of information. It is, I think, the greatest journalism tradition from my eyes and my ears. And to see these voices resonate again, I hope, to a new generation or for folks who remember them and didn't know where to find them, it's a joy. It feels it's a tribute album. It really is the equivalent. I feel, you know, not to put too highfalutin a point on it, but almost like Alan Lomax recovering these recordings from different regions. And hopefully it'll start a resurgence. All these figures, all these columnists should have their own books back in print, new anthologies that people can read. These folks should be celebrated as artists and journalists and help us all adjust our expectations upward.
Do you how to put this, were there ever any moments as you've been collecting these pieces that you got kind of depressed about the quality of writing today? I mean, you know, you say, look, there's still good writing going on, but is this form or is this kind of attention at all changing or is it different nowadays?
Well, I where I thought you were getting is the real truth, which is to make me acutely aware of my own failings and
no,
shortcomings
that's not right.
as a columnist. Yes, it certainly does that. Look, I don't want to be a you know, we have so much more opportunity for information at our hands. If we are falling short of these standards, by and large, it's our own responsibility, and we completely have the power to address that and adjust that. You don't need to romanticize the past. I think it's pretty clear when you read Liza's columns that in some cases, journalistic ethics may not have always been the first consideration of some of these columnists way back in the day. They got great quotes from people while spending a lot of time at bars. That said, you know, just being real about it. That said, it is a challenge and I hope a bit of a wake-up call, because I think we have gotten a bit lazy writing columns without leaving our computers or there's not enough not even knocking on doors, picking up the telephone,
yeah.
of reporting a column out, of remembering the primacy of telling a story, not simply typing out your own opinion. These deadlines were just as crushing, even more so, because frankly, online, you know, you can miss a deadline and you can file a few hours late. In this case, the paper was going off to print. And you see the breaking news situations, the literature that some of these people produced. It is an improvisational art form as much as jazz, but it is rooted in fact, and that makes it all the more impressive. And so while I think there's no denying that the tradition of the classic reported column is an endangered species right now.
Yeah.
There are people doing great work in cities across the country. And I think what's important is to celebrate them. John L. Smith in Las Vegas. I mentioned Steve Lopez in the Los Angeles Times, Mitch Albom, nationally known in Detroit, Carl Hyacin in Miami. There are many. Colbert King in the Washington Post. It's not simply about the Mount Olympus column, you know, the memo to public figures about what they should do at any given crossroads of history. It's about telling people's stories and shining a light where the light hasn't been shown.
Yeah.
We can do that. So I don't despair, but I do see this as a clear challenge to those of us who are doing this today. And frankly, a challenge that readers should start demanding more of themselves, and encouraging newspapers and websites to direct their resources more in this direction, because it can produce something really rare and rich and in some cases enduring.
I want to come out of the show with one of my favorite pieces in the collection. This is a piece from Brady Dennis. It's a rather short, brief piece, and really its beauty, I have to say. It's called After the Sky Fell, from January of 2005, which shows that people are still writing good stuff. It's a piece written in the St. Petersburg Times. Briefly, John, you want to say something about this before we play?
Sure. This is a reminder. I mean, this book does go up to the present day. There are deadline artists still writing today. And this column by Brady Dennis, who now at the Washington Post, was written very quickly. That's telling. He said he wrote this very quickly. Sometimes it's not the time you spend. It's the inspiration and the tight focus. And Brady Dennis is fairly young. This is a classic, a rumination on a man who works at a toll booth on a bridge in Tampa, in the Tampa Bay area, and answering the question that sometimes goes through our minds, which is, who is this person? Why is he there? And this column looks at this man's story in a almost poetic form.
The few drivers on this dark, lonely stretch of Suncoast Parkway in Pasco County pull up to the toll booth, hand their dollars to Lloyd Blair, and then speed away. None of them knows why the old man sits here night after night working the graveyard shift. Well, here's why. Because years ago, on a freezing winter night at a party in Queens, New York, he met a woman named Millie. Because he fell in love with her brown hair and wide eyes and 100-watt smile. Because they got married, moved to Staten Island, had a son, and worked for decades in Manhattan. She is an accountant. He is a banker. Because it had been their dream to retire in Florida. And so they saved all their lives to make it possible. Because just as they began talking of leaving New York and heading south, she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and they spent their time and money traveling to New Jersey, San Diego, and Mexico in search of a cure. Because in the end, they came to Florida anyway. Because they finally bought a house in Spring Hill, although she was too weak that day to get out of the car. Because she died 9 days later on January 5th, 2002, a day the whole sky fell, he says. Because after she was gone, he found himself alone and $100,000 in debt. And so he took a job collecting tolls. The drivers who pass by see a smiling 71-year-old man with blue eyes and a gray mustache who tells each of them, "Have a great night." They don't know the rest of Lloyd Blair's story, or that he keeps Millie's picture in his shirt pocket just under his name tag, just over his heart.
It's a piece called After the Sky Fell by Brady Dennis. John Avalon is a senior columnist for Newsweek and the Daily Beast. He co-edited Deadline Artists, Scandals, Tragedies, and Triumphs, more of America's greatest newspaper columns. John, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. It's a real pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Paul Kiernan for all of those readings that he did on such a deadline. Our thanks to Taylor Almond as well, the program produced by Lane Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.